appointed fiduciary may bring litigation against somebody who they believe has done something wrong, and that's going to cost money. And then if the person that loses appeals, that's going to cost the estate money, not any different than any other type of litigation. And so it's hard to, you know, to say, well, they spent a lot of money in a particular case, yes, but it, and to lay the blame on the fiduciary, because it may be it's the duty of the fiduciary to proceed against somebody. Just like I've had cases in front of me where the fiduciary who, you know, was not named by the court, they wouldn't proceed against a wrongdoer because they were doing something wrong themselves. And so, but I've made these suggestions. And I will say one thing about another change. We want to talk a little bit about changing the recusal statute. I don't think there's anything wrong with our recusal statute, other than we have some litigants who now have figured out, and this can happen under Chapter 74 or Chapter 25 or any recusal provision, that what they will do is any judge assigned gets a recusal, to hear a recusal, gets a recusal filed against them. And that can go on and on and on, because the tertiary recusal provision that you all set up under the Practice and Remedies Code says that if a person files against one judge, or a, it says a judge, it doesn't say one judge, but it says if a person files the third recusal against a judge, that's tertiary, and that judge can proceed to onward, and on appeal, if the judge was wrong, should have been recused or disqualified, then everything is set aside. But if you think about that, under Chapter 74 or Chapter 25, presiding judge assigns a judge, he goes down to hear it, she has got a motion to recuse her, we send another judge down there to hear the recusal on the recusal judge, she gets a recusal filed against her, we send a third judge down to hear that recusal, now we're hearing the recusal on the recusal on the recusal judge, they file a recusal on that, and you just keep going snowballing over the situation. We've had non-parties. Recusal statutes are filed by parties, not by the lawyer. The lawyer can do it on behalf of the client, but in a particular case that I delivered to you, the one that I say that all the remands, you will find that individuals who are lawyers have on their own behalf filed a motion to recuse, and even under 74, under 25, there is no provision for a lawyer to say, I want to recuse the judge on my own behalf. It's just not there. You all have never authorized that. And if you want to do that, that's fine, but you're not doing that. But that's the kind of recusals that we're seeing in some areas. And then when I send someone down to go hear that, they got a motion to recuse them. And so there are some problems. I think I've made some recommendations as to how to solve those problems, but a lot of the problems.
I don't think we have those up here.
I handed them, they're the legislative changes.
For recusals?
No, not on the recusals. And I don't, what I would do on recusals would change the business of whether it be in 74 or in 25 is to say that, and it's actually would have to be changed in the tertiary recusal motion in section 31 of the Practice and Remedies Code, and say that the third motion to recuse against any judge in a case, not one judge, but any judge, is tertiary, and then that judge can proceed. Obviously, if they're wrong on appeal, it'll be reversed. But when you have a situation where it's individually a single judge, and then you bring a judge in to hear that, you'll just run out of judges ultimately and have an absurd result.
Question. Senator Gallegos.
Judge, let me ask you, you've already given me a headache on recusals, and I'm not a lawyer, but when you go into a case like this, whether it be $250,000, whether the estate or, you know, let's say $100 million, and then whoever picks the guardian or administrator, whatever he or she is called, that the judge would look at the entire amount involved and then pick the guardian overseeing the case. And first of all, I have a few questions. Number one, if the other side or whoever continues to make these recusals, I mean, where, is there a stopping point on recusals? I would anticipate there's money involved in each motion for recusal. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. It's okay. Two sets of money.
Then why so many in a certain case? recusals. If one party is continuing to recuse, whether they recuse for they feel strong about their side, or there's something wrong with the bench, or you know, or the money involved as opposed to whoever they hire as the guardian, that there's going to be money left at the end of the argument. You know, first of all, let's go on recusals. Okay. Is there a limit on recusals?
Current statute says that if a party files three recusals against a judge, then the judge who had on the third time can continue hearing the underlying case. But if the Court of Appeals on appeal thinks that was a good recusal or disqualification motion, it could reverse the result.
Well, under that scenario, let's say I'm the judge, Judge A, picks a guardian, and all of a sudden recusals start, and you're looking, and the judge overseeing the umbrella of the estate, seeing that recusals alone are going to exhaust the funds in the kitty, and whatever lawyers charge on recusals, or whatever the court charges are, or total charges on a motion to recuse, that the presiding judge is looking. I mean, he or she knows what's involved as far as funds, I would guess, or a window, you know, or if it's an oil well, the interest up on that daily, or I'm sure a CPA can find out, you know, how much that thing is going to be worth, whatever they're fighting over, the estate's going to be worth in 10 years. What I'm saying here is that you're in a courtroom, recusals are being, the motions are being put out in front of the court, and you're looking at a set of funds in a certain window, and all of a sudden those funds are exhausted just on recusals alone. You never get to the case, you know, and I'm talking about from you know, like I said, I'm not a lawyer. I'm talking about a layman. Let's say fighting over $200,000 as opposed to $200 million, you know, in court transactions, or you know, I was looking at an article where, and don't get me wrong, I like lawyers as the John's not a lawyer. John, are you a lawyer? You're not a lawyer. Okay, that's one of the only two non-lawyers on this committee sitting down right now. Is that, you know, I understand that attorneys have fees to be charged and all that, but when I see $50 a sentence, and then sometimes they forget what they charge $25,000 for, I forget, you know, what I charge this for, and it's not in the statement or anything, you know, that $200,000 family that's going into a probate case like this is going to start worrying once recusals start being motioned, and then all of a sudden at the end of the day there's nothing to fight over.
And your question for Judge Herman
is why, number one, why so many recusals, number one?
Well, I'm only aware, you know, as presiding judge, I've had two cases in this term, it's been since January, where there's an inordinate number of recusals. One that you heard Ms. Norman speak about in Houston, and then I've got one up out of Dallas County. And there, you know, you assign a judge to go hear the recusal, and in one case, it's, I want to recuse that judge. You send another judge in, I want to recuse that judge. And bear in mind, this is the family, or some members of the family. I mean, if you're talking about a guardianship, in order to even get to a point of a guardianship, there's an allegation, a sworn allegation, and a medical certificate alleging that someone is incapacitated. And generally speaking, what you're going to see, they're incapacitated and somebody is doing something wrong with them, their money, their property, or whatever. I've got one out of Dallas where it's a decedent's estate. We're not dealing with an incapacitated person, but we've got an administrator. The rest of the family wants to remove that administrator for wrongdoing. And that administrator files motions to recuse, first the judge, that being heard, it's denied, then files a motion for new trial and has a motion to recuse. The judge coming down to hear that, has a motion to recuse any assigned judge, and every time you turn around, there's a motion to recuse somebody. All of that is going to cost that family money. But you're in a situation, even in many instances, if that judge up in Dallas recused himself, the next judge there would have the same motion to recuse filed against them, and that's what we're seeing down in Harris County. And that's why I think that the tertiary recusal motion provision, and this would apply to any recusal, it shouldn't be based on just three against a particular judge, because I assign a judge to go hear it, and then that one gets one. Then I have to sign another one. That one gets one. A third one. That one gets one. A fourth. And those aren't tertiary. Or you have, in this particular case, we have a person who, the spouse, who's opposed to a guardianship, she's filing motions to recuse. We've got somebody who's an intervener. He's filing motions to recuse. Then we have someone who claims to represent the alleged ward filing motions to recuse in the same case, and each of them under the statute would be entitled three against one judge. And what you see is I've got one, then it's denied, you've got one, then it goes down, and then here comes the judge to hear the recusal. It's denied. I mean, it's just continual recusal, and that's the problem in a case. And you get situations where a person who's alleged to have mental incapacity and who's alleged to have been taken care of, we never see in court. We have not seen this person in court in a long time. Doesn't show up, can't find him. And everyone knows that there is a large sum of money, and that money is dwindling. It's dwindling in legal fees. It's dwindling in court costs. Harris County taxpayers are paying money for judges to come down there and hear recusals.
All right, Judge. My second question would be, I guess, that whether it be $1 or $1 billion, that, and I have not seen your proposals, but that a judge could pick a guardian with a budget, and they said you can't go over this budget as far as a limit. That way, the parties that are fighting, it's going to be, some money left for somebody. And I haven't heard, I don't know if that's in your proposal.
Well, it's setting fees. I mean, there's restraints on courts to set lawyers' fees to be reasonable and necessary. Those things we look at. And lawyers are to be setting their fees based upon a lot of different criteria, the difficulty of the case, the going rate in the community. I'll be real frank. I'm shocked when I see the hourly rates in Harris County or in Dallas County, but compared to Austin, although Austin is slowly but surely getting that way. But if I look down in Bexar County, the rates in Austin and Bexar County have historically been somewhat similar. Tarrant County is lower than in Dallas. But those are it's not just in probate they're high rates. In Harris County, they have hourly rates that are higher than they are out in the rural areas and certainly higher than they are in other urban areas. And there's a lot, Harris County's big. It's hard to get across. Lots of different things going on. But we do look at those things.
Senator Harris has a question. Senator Harris?
Judge, help me. I'm not much good on appellate work. Whenever it's appealed, to get the case reversed as far as the judge and to get the court to find that judge should have been recused and thereby void the orders of that judge, the standard on that is what's the standard?
On appeal?
On a recusal. What's the standard
recusal? Because after the third recusal, third judge goes ahead and hears it, if I understood you.
It would be the same standard. I don't think it's abuse of discretion. It's just that was the judge recusable? Should he have been recused is the way the court
of appeal. But that's not by preponderance of the evidence.
Well, it would be. I go and hear a recusal motion. People put on evidence, and sometimes you get people, I've been in a couple of cases recently where they don't put on.
That's what I'm talking about on appeal.
Well, they're just going to look.
What is the appellate court? What is the standard that the appellate court uses to determine that? Doesn't it almost have to be abuse of discretion? Would have to be, wouldn't it?
You know, I really can't say because I never pay that much attention to the appellate courts. They, you know, one thing you're supposed to
They'd
come.
Be disappointed
I do pay
to
attention
that,
to. Yeah. I didn't mean it that way. I don't read the. You know, one thing is that you most of your mandamus cases, most of your recusals are done with the appeal. That it was a error not to recuse the judge, but it can be done on mandamus, although it's usually not done on mandamus. And I just haven't looked at the opinions that have. It's usually mandamus is denied, and they don't come out and say, "Well, we decided that didn't meet a burden of proof." It just said it's denied. I have seen, I can tell you of. And I've given you, in a particular case, there was the day of the recusal hearing, the recusal judge had a motion to recuse filed against him. That judge took the position, and after it's been on appeal, it was found by at least the courts over in Harris County to be incorrect, was that if you file it on the day of the hearing, that it's untimely filed and I can proceed. That was the judge's view. The Court of Appeals.
It's supposed to be 3 days, isn't it, at least?
Well, actually, what the Court of Appeals said that there is a 10-day rule. You have to file it 10 days before a hearing. But once a recusal motion is filed, you need to refer it to the presiding judge, period.
Yeah.
No and ifs or buts about it. You don't get to decide whether it was untimely. The presiding judge gets to decide whether it's untimely or not. And so that judge, there was a mandamus issued against that judge. Now,
so, Judge Arnold, are we getting down to that we don't, that those of us on the committee and yourself are not familiar with the standard that the appellate court uses to make its ruling? And, Mr. Chairman, could I ask that one of your committee lawyers researches that?
We only have one committee lawyer, but I'll ask her.
And Senator Harris, there's some lawyers here, and they may know how the courts of appeals look at that.
Well, the way sides seem to be divided up, I don't know that I trust either side to tell me.
One more question. Senator Gallegos has one last question.
Yes, sir.
Judge, let me ask you. You said things are different from Travis or Amarillo, Harris. I mean, doesn't law apply to?
I'm talking about the legal fees. I'm talking about the charges that lawyers charge, not the law.
Reasonable customary fees.
You said Dallas and Harris County lawyers charge more than.
That's the general. I think Travis people would generally agree that in Dallas and Harris County, the legal fee per hour is higher than it is in Travis, Bear, Tarrant, and out in Potter.
Or Amarillo, Lubbock.
Amarillo. Although I must say that when the first time I can remember. 15 years ago when the Harris County and Dallas law firms came in here, our fees were much lower than they are today, and our fees have gradually gone up to where they are closer and bumping near the Dallas and the Tarrant and the Harris County. And I think probably Tarrant County has kind of crept up in that same guard as these law firms have come here. Because that the market bears those fees.
But in probate law in the state of Texas, they're all under the same umbrella. Is that correct? Other than the fees.
Statewide.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Probate law doesn't change from county to county. Any more questions for Judge Herman? Thank you very much, Judge. Appreciate your being here. Senator Harris, I'd like you to get a haircut. Mr. Epstein. And Mr. How do you pronounce that? Wilkerson.
Wilkerson.
As well. You want to appear together?
Please.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning.
Good morning. Identify yourself and proceed.
Senator, my name is David Wilkerson. I'm here on behalf of my client, Mr. J. Michael Epstein, as well as myself.
Thank you, sir.
I'm Mike Epstein on behalf of myself.
Thank you, sir.
Senators, good morning. You should have before you a report which we have prepared, Mr. Epstein and I, over the course of some time. Mr. Epstein is not only my client, he's my dear friend. And during the course of this, hopefully, discussion, we will talk about some of the facts that we have seen. Our intent has been to be objective. We're not here to talk about any one particular judge or any one particular lawyer. In your report, you will find that we have assembled information which has been promulgated and given to the Supreme Court. As most of you are aware, there's a Supreme Court order that says that when you are a court appointee, your fees must be gathered by the county or the district court clerk and sent to the Supreme Court once a month. We have tried to take that information and provide that information to you here today. We'll also talk a bit briefly about my client's mother, Mrs. Alta Epstein. Mrs. Alta Epstein is an elderly Alzheimer's patient and has been unable to care for herself. Again, our goal is not to talk about any one particular aspect of a case. It's just that we are more familiar with Mrs. Epstein's case, and we'll give you some examples today. During the course of our discussion, I'd like to review some of the particular provisions contained with our report. If any of you don't have it, we have extras with us if you need them.
I think we all have copies. It's a loose leaf binder. You're talking about this one?
Yes, sir. It should be a one-inch binder, white. Right.
Now, before you get too far down the road, we really are interested in your recommendations of ways to improve the system and not go into a lot of detail about your specific case, which I understand is still pending.
It is pending, right. And we really don't want to do that either. We're not here to talk about the case.
Good.
Kindly, we think that's improper. We're here primarily to talk about Section 665 of the Texas Probate Code and Section 666 of the Texas Probate Code. They are contained within the appendix contained within the binder.
Good.
And I am not a probate lawyer, and I'm not an appellate lawyer, so I can't answer those questions. I primarily do civil trial and family work. One thing to please be aware of, when Mrs. Epstein started her guardianship, she had about $1.2 million. She had an annual income of approximately $100,000 per year. Today, she lives on Social Security, and she has about $300,000 in assets.
She has what?
About $300,000 in assets left. She had $1.2 million. During the course of her guardianship proceeding, she had income of over $2 million.
When did the guard, over what period of time are you referring to, sir?
Sir, it's about 10 years in her
10
guardianship.
Years.
Yes, sir.
And it had been growing, the estate had, if I understood you correctly, what, about a 5% return?
A little bit better than that. She had one asset that was sold for $800,000 that was generating over $100,000 a year in income.
Net
we'll
income.
We'll talk a bit about that asset.
Net income?
Gross income, sir.
Income.
Gross before taxes.
Okay. So it was net income?
Yes, sir, it was income.
Okay.
We think it's too late for Mrs. Epstein's mother. We're not here to talk about a relief for her. But this report hopefully will delve into many people and many aspects of the law for which it's not too late. There are situations that you may have the ability to change certain aspects of the law to prevent what we have seen to be a problem in the way attorney, guardian, appointees are paid. The primary reason Mrs. Epstein's estate has been diminished to the extent it has been that the payment of attorney, appointee, guardians has been just simply outrageous. As Judge Herman says, he has standards which he has promulgated and which are on his website. You can go to his court and their handouts. Judge Herman, in his standard, says that in the rare situation that he appoints an attorney as a fiduciary and they serve in a dual capacity, he pays them no more than $50 per hour. Attorney's fees have decimated Mrs. Epstein's estate. The report shows, beginning in under tab 3, we took the information that was given to the Texas Supreme Court and we got it in soft copy. We made no independent analysis of the information. The shocking number is that court appointees in the 4 probate courts in Harris County, Texas, in an 11-year period of time, have been awarded $87 million in court appointee fees. Of that sum, $64 million went to court appointee guardians. We're talking one county in this state. We've given you graphs to show how that money has been spent. We've shown you to whom it's been awarded. It is a large number. Judge Herman talked a bit about the statutory compensation guidelines. That's section 665 of the Texas Probate Code. Generally, it says that a guardian should be awarded 5% of the income and 5% of the expenses of the ward's estate on an annual basis. If there is a guardian of the person who's also been appointed, that guardian shares in that statutory calculation. Sometimes 5% is just too low. We do agree with Judge Herman. If you have a small estate and a lot of work, it just seems to us that's just too low. Regrettably, our analysis has been that it's not the statutory fee that gets paid. It is the payment of attorney appointee guardians who charge their regular hourly rates. For example, in Mrs. Epstein's case, she is on her second court-appointed guardian. Each court-appointed guardian has been a lawyer. Each court-appointed guardian has charged attorney's fees. There has never been a motion nor an order determined that the 5% in and 5% out was too low. All this happens, they simply charge their attorney's fees. The shocking part is that each court-appointed guardian has also had his or her own lawyer to represent them. So when you go to a hearing, you have the court appointee guardian charging an hourly rate, as well as his attorney charging an hourly rate. This can be cured. We have offered some suggestions for curing, and we're not trying to be presumptive. It's just that we've seen this, and we think that Section 665 and Section 666 of the Texas Probate Code can be modified so that court appointee guardians get paid a reasonable sum. They should be entitled to have a lawyer represent them. And by the way, when a court appointee guardian hires a lawyer, it is my understanding that lawyer represents the guardian and not the ward. We just don't think that's right. Another one of the suggestions we make, and Senator Harris, I understand you're a family law lawyer.
Yes, sir.
You understand the best interest test probably better than anybody in this room. There's no best interest test in the probate code when it comes to determining what is good for the ward. There talks about some best interest here and there about things, but it really isn't important. You will find, for example, that when the court orders the sale of property, the only issue is whether or not a fair value for that property was received, and not whether or not the sale was in the best interest. For example, we have found that income-producing property, which yields a fine return, can be sold, but yet it's only the value is determined, not whether it's really good for the ward to sell it or not.
I'm sorry, I didn't. You trailed off in your last.
Have a tendency to do
saying.
That,
sir.
I have a tendency to do that. I'm trying to avoid specifics. What we have discovered, sir, is that there is no best interest test in the probate code.
Understood that.
We would suggest that there be simply
understood that.
Okay. In our particular circumstance, a piece of property was sold.
Understood. It was income producing.
But and you know it only was sold for $850 after the payment of taxes, attorney's fees. $300,000 was left for the ward. Yet it was generating, sir, about $100,000 a year. And what we're simply suggesting, if there was an overall best interest test that the court could have looked to,
I believe the court would not have sold that piece of property. But the law, as currently written, says that the only consideration for the court is whether or not a fair value for that property is received.
I don't see how you can go from $850,000 to $300,000. I mean, you take out 10% closing costs for the realtor, for the title company, you're down to $750,000, say. Not even, you know, yeah, $750,000. Are you telling me there was $450,000 in attorney fees associated with the sale?
No, sir, I'm not. There was zero basis in the property, so there was a high tax, income tax paid on the property. Once the property was sold, the remaining, a large portion of the proceeds went to pay the court-appointed guardian's attorney's fees, as well as his lawyer's.
So you're telling me there was a substantial recapture that had to be taxed as ordinary income?
No, sir, I believe it was a long-term capital gain, but there was just, the basis was very low in the property. It had been depreciated over a number of years, so that they paid taxes, capital gains taxes, on nearly 100% of the sales proceeds.
At what rate?
It would have been 15%.
Long-term capital gains rate.
I'm still not understanding how you got down to $300,000.
There was also a $200,000 loan that the guardian had initiated with the adjacent landowner for the cleanup of the property. And the property was sold to the adjacent landowner prior to the loan actually coming due. And we'll talk a little bit more about it a little bit later on in the report.
All right, thank you.
Let me ask you, we heard Judge Herman make a recommendation to change Section 666 that you're talking about. And the one-sentence suggestion that he's making is that we should add, in calculating reasonable attorney's fees, the court shall award fees only for the performance of legal services. And I presume from your testimony you'd agree with that recommendation?
I have not seen Judge Herman's suggestion. I'm probably more visual. No,
I just read it to you.
I would probably agree.
In calculating reasonable attorney's fees, the court shall award fees only for the performance of legal services.
Yes, sir. I believe I would agree with that.
Okay. That was my question.
We have never taken the position that a guardian should not have the right to hire a lawyer if he or she thinks that's appropriate, and that lawyer should be paid a reasonable fee. Our issue is when, as Judge Herman calls, the fiduciary is a lawyer and hires himself or herself to be the lawyer as well as a guardian for the ward or the estate.
Well, and his additional concern was that once hired, they charge their regular hourly rate for doing things that are basically clerical or administrative that should be done by someone not licensed to practice law.
Judge Herman has it right, yeah, in our opinion.
Senator Gallegos has a question.
Mr. Wilkerson, let me, in your initial testimony, you said reasonable amount. Can you define a reasonable amount for me?
Yes, sir, I think I can. I can probably do it by way of example, if you would. If you turn to please tab 6 of the report, beginning on page 33. My friend, Mr. Epstein, went to the courts and actually reviewed some of the files, which are public records, of the 30 highest paid guardians in Harris County. We determined the 30 highest paid guardians by looking simply at the information which was filed with the Supreme Court. Beginning on page 33 is an excerpt of one lawyer who was charged over $7,000 simply to open and close bank accounts. Now, Senator Gallegos, I can probably answer your question by saying that's clearly not reasonable. No one should ever charge, particularly a guardian. This guardian was appointed by the court to watch over the ward's estate. So what did he do? He went to the bank for 5 hours on October 25, 2003. He met with somebody. He closed one bank account, went to another bank account, and inventoried a safe deposit box. He charged almost $1,400 to do that. In the probate code, there is a section for private professional guardians. people who may have retired from large companies, people who believe in simply helping. There are many people out there who could qualify to help those of us in our aging society who may need guardians at any point in time. Many people we've spoken to think that if you have a will, this will never affect me. I've taken care of that in my will. That's not true. If you're determined to be incapacitated, the court should appoint a guardian for you. It's just when that guardian is a lawyer and charges his or her hourly rate to do mundane guardianship work, that's where the problem is centered. And that's why we believe that Section 665 and 666 should be modified.
Now, do you have anywhere in this binder language that you propose to be done? I see in tab 11, the conclusion is a one-page sort of executive summary, but I don't see any specific language.
Yes, sir, we do. If you look under tab 9. And what we have done is simply take the existing law of certain statutes and have lined through what we think to be inappropriate language and inserted language which we believe would assist this committee in finding some legislative change. For example, under Section 665, Roman 3, lowercase c, we said, should the court modify the statutory commission formula, the court may authorize fees not to exceed a maximum rate of $50 per hour. Now, that language was not ours. That language is Judge Herman's. If you go, please, to tab number 8 of the binder, we have included the standards for approval of fee petitions, which have been promulgated by Judge Herman. The $50 per hour language is his. Now, that's only when the attorney serves as the fiduciary. It is not when the fiduciary hires an attorney. Judge Herman has standards in his, has hourly rates and dollar amounts in his standards for the attorney, for the fiduciary, up to $275 per hour. And Senator Gallegos, I would assume that that would be a reasonable rate, up to $275 an hour for a lawyer with 11 plus years experience, be it Harris County or Travis County. We've also included several other matters which we believe may be considered for proposed legislation. Under page 56, we talk about the best interest test. Under tab 57, we talk about the appealability of an order. I know this committee is interested in saving dollars for their wards. We have discovered that each and every time a probate court orders the payment of fiduciary fees, that is a final appealable order, and that it does not go on to the final accounting. We believe that there are thousands per month of fee appointments in this county, in this state. Thus, you would have many thousands of final appealable orders. We believe that it would be appropriate that when a guardian finishes his or her work and does a final accounting, which is required in the probate code, that that would be the appropriate time during which the final order would come in, that all previous orders simply be interlocutory until that point in time. And thereafter, an appeal could raise. Yes, sir.
Mr. Wilkinson, let me ask you this. Under reasonable amount and under would this include all costs incurred on motions and maps and drafts and everything, including in a case, in probate court? Would that reasonable amount all fees?
Let me explain, sir, so that we're clear with each other. You have a guardian who is appointed. Under 665, he or she currently gets 5% in and 5% out. Unless the court determines that sum to be unreasonably low, then the court can expand that fee. The guardian also has the right to hire a lawyer. So you have reasonable fees for both the guardian and the guardian's counsel. We have suggested, and we have simply adopted Judge Herman's suggestion, that if Judge Herman has suggested that the guardian make a choice when he or she is appointed. Either accept the statutory compensation or request reimbursement of an hourly rate between $25 and $50 per hour. So we think, yes, that would be a reasonable fee for the guardian. The guardian's attorney, we believe, should be paid a reasonable fee above that sum. There are cases in which the guardian needs special professionals other than lawyers, could need an accountant, could need an engineer. The guardian should have the right to hire those people and pay them also a reasonable fee. Does that answer your question, sir?
Well, it does, but let me ask you this. At the time everything's about to be settled, and the lawyer and all parties go before the judge, and the attorney that was granted guardianship, he or she says, "Judge, we felt like we were shortchanged here, and we want to file an extra added amount to the following cost." Under present state law, is he or she allowed to do that?
Under 665, I believe that the guardian would be allowed to do so. Yes. That also begs one question.
Well, and then you go back to reasonable amount. If what you say and what Judge Herman said, a reasonable amount, then he or she files a motion, hey, we feel we should have got another 100 grand.
Yeah, but it's not only reasonable amount, but also has to find that it was necessary work on the estate.
And the judge makes that?
Reasonable and necessary is the standard the judge is obligated to.
Okay.
There's one more
that
threshold.
Necessary is the key on what you're saying.
Gotcha.
The other threshold would be 1.04 of the state bar rules for lawyers. There's seven items or so that a lawyer should look to in determining his or her fee. What fees charged in the county, the novelty of the question, the experience of the lawyer in that particular area. Those would be for lawyers' fees, but not for guardians' fees. Another thing that we propose, and sometimes lawyers aren't best at doing certain things in life, and certainly I believe that there are many people, many other professions, who are probably more well-skilled to serve as guardians other than lawyers, as long as that guardian has the right to hire a lawyer when needed. It's just not always needed. There are many people out there who would gladly volunteer their time. Certainly Gallegos in Harris County. Harris County has a guardianship program, which we have visited. It is fabulous. Those people do it right. They're well-trained. They take care of their wards. They visit their wards at least once a month. How many lawyers are going to find time out of their schedules, realistically, to go visit their wards? It just isn't appropriate. The guardianship programs that you have in this state should be implemented more. Private professional guardians are provided for within the Texas Probate Code, and I know I'm being redundant. They just simply aren't used. And we also suggest that if a family member or a next of kin, which the Probate Code currently provides in order of priority, should be a guardian, if they are not willing or statutorily able to serve, that a private professional guardian be mandated to be used. I don't think lawyers are the best choice to take care of incapacitated people.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Harris.
Yeah, we've already talked about putting the best interest standard into this part of the probate code. Now, under best interest, wouldn't that apply directly to what you're talking about right now? What is in the best interest of the ward?
It would certainly have an overlap, Senator Harris, but I'm afraid that the probate code also provides that if the spouse of the ward or the next of kin of the ward in order of priority doesn't choose to serve, then the court can appoint someone else. We're just simply suggesting that category of someone else be a private professional guardian. That would save the wards a lot of money and also render so much more compassionate care.
I'm not trying to be argumentative with you. What I'm saying with the best interest standard in the law and the judge being obligated to look for, to handle it in the best interest of the ward, It just seems to me like it would make it more likely that a judge would use the approach you're talking about. Mr. Chairman, I'd also like to make a statement to the chair.
You bet.
I've had a number of groups come to me in my district that are really concerned that we're going to mess up the area where the volunteer guardians can serve, Mr. Chairman, and that we may make it in such a way that it knocks out people who are interested in doing it. And so I'd ask the committee to keep that in mind, Mr. Chairman, sure, as we proceed.
You bet.
Because I've had two large groups come to me so far.
And Senator Harris, if a person wishes to be a volunteer guardian, I think they still have to qualify under the probate code. And I don't believe that anything that we have suggested would cancel those people out. In fact, what we're trying to do is encourage those people to come in and serve as guardians for wards.
Okay.
Let me suggest, in the interest of time and a whole host of other witnesses that have signed up this morning, you've got on page 53, looks like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 recommendations for proposed legislation. You've already spoken about several of them, but I don't think you've touched on all of them. If you'd like to, because this is what we're here to receive, suggestions from people on how we can improve legislation. If you'd like to go through those that you haven't already touched, the chair would be interested in your doing that at this point, and whatever Mr. Epstein would like to add as well.
Thank you. I'd be happy to, and I'll try to be brief.
All right, sir.
On page 62 of the report, we talk about the issue of insolvency. We discovered that if a ward is determined to be insolvent under the code as currently written, which is section 805 of the probate code, that the administrative costs of the ward take precedence over his or her health care and maintenance expenses. We believe that's backwards. We believe that the ward's health care and maintenance expenses should always be paid first and not court appointee fees. Thus, we suggest the changes, which you'll find on page 62, to limit those and to also say that attorney's fees are administered.